Hi, this is Paul. The question of whether or not Jordan Peterson is a Christian is something that gets debated up and down Facebook groups, Twitter, YouTube comment threads. Some people say, of course Jordan Peterson is a Christian. Other people say, of course Jordan Peterson isn't a Christian. Jordan Peterson doesn't go to church. Jordan Peterson won't say he believes in God. Is Jordan Peterson a Christian or not? Jordan Peterson has answered this question a number of times, and he's answered it both ways. And so it's been a huge debate, and this debate has been raging for at least the year plus that I've been doing videos. I have various videos commenting on it, but I saw something recently that changed my mind. So we'll get into that. This is the question, and this is the statement. Jordan Peterson is a Christian in Soren Kierkegaard. Now, that's a rather nuanced, complicated way of saying it, but then Jordan Peterson is a nuanced, complicated man. Let's get into it. The question of whether Jordan Peterson is a Christian, of course, depends on what your definition of a Christian is. Now, in the past, I've given my simplest definition, which is a Christian is someone who believes in Jesus more than they believe in themselves. But I'm not actually going to deal with that one in this video. I've dealt with it in past videos. The big reason that this question keeps getting brought up is the tribal aspect. Jordan Peterson is at the top of the hierarchy and the culture war IDW conversations. And whether or not he's a Christian or whether he gives too much aid and comfort to Christian in Sam Harris's opinion or in the opinions of other celebrity atheists in the IDW ranks always gets pulled up. The only person in the IDW that I can think of at the top of my head, at least in the prominent list, who would answer yes definitively to whether or not they believe in God would be Ben Shapiro. Jordan Peterson keeps saying, "I act as if God exists." A lot of this grows out of the fact that many people in our culture believe you can't maintain credibility as a scientist and be a Christian. And in fact, that debate rages, and someone just pointed me out to a new channel that basically says you can't be a scientist and not be a Christian. And so this is something that continually goes back and forth. And the question of how Jordan Peterson regards Christianity and the resurrection and Jesus was in many ways at the center of the conversations with Sam Harris that Jordan Peterson had last year. And that's where I get Jordan Peterson's God number one and God number two. Just recently, Peter Boghossian had made some comments about this, and Peter Boghossian has talked about this realignment. And whereas I sort of disagree with how this is laid out, I think for many modernists that think there's a objective truth that you can make objective truth claims, the split has happened with respect to critical theory, postmodern neo-Marxism, however you want to slice that. But it's the question between objectivity and subjectivity. And so Peter Boghossian thinks that there's been sort of a realignment where you have a lot of modernist apologists who, in fact, 3 or 4 years ago would have been debating Peter Boghossian as rivals. Now, in a sense, they lock arms to do battle with the social justice groups. And so this is sort of a new alignment, and this is Peter Boghossian's idea. And if you want to look at it, I made a video about this a few videos ago. If you just search Peter Boghossian in my stream, you can see the video that I made about that. Last year, Mouthy Buddha did an excellent video on, is Sam Harris losing his audience to Jordan Peterson? And then in one of the conversations that I had with Dr. James, he made a point that I've played in a previous video, and I played it in, obviously, in the conversation I had with him, but I still think bears listening to answer the question why Jordan Peterson rose so prominently and why this new arrangement has played out as it has.
10 years from now, of course, it's pure speculation, what will be Jordan Peterson's contribution to the decade?
Yeah, that is a good question, because that reminds me of a direction that I was wanting to go in, which I think dovetails into your question pretty well. I think the starting point of Jordan Peterson was the response to the new atheists and their claim that the commons, the kind of secular commons, had a metaphysical basis that everyone had to adopt in order to create a unified vision. And that's, and that secular, their vision was that the secular foundation was reductive materialism and naturalism. And their proposal was that we needed to do away with the transcendent and get on board in seeing the same world as a unified, you know, world consciousness in order to get rid of these crazy religious types who were doing crazy things. And that didn't wash, partly because the argument that what the guys who flew those planes into those buildings did was reprehensible had already been agreed to by everybody. So the fact that they were making that argument in a very caustic and angry way, you know, kind of gets you a splash initially, but it's like, well, but we all agreed to that. we all agree with that. So that doesn't go anywhere. And then in the back of it was this metaphysical claim. That is to say, before, the secular commons was respecting everybody's individual metaphysical commitments, including transcendent ones. And it was allowing those to exist. I mean, the Puritans didn't come to America to give up their Puritanism.
No, they did not.
Right. So that's the wrong vision of the commons. That is to say that we need to go to Tyson, the guy who did Cosmos, very explicitly says this in that series, that what we need is the common vision. And the source of that common vision is scientism. Let's say. That's the common vision. That'll unify us. That'll allow us to have conversations together and do good things. And that didn't wash because reductive materialism, naturalism, and a non-transcendent worldview can't be sustained in any kind of, you know, in any kind of way. And so Jordan Peterson stepped into the breach of that. And then all of these metaphysical commitments that have their own version of a transcendent element to them, religious, spiritual, philosophical types, they all said, hey, he's our guy. So what you've got is a kind of a pluralistic group who are standing kind of facing the new atheists in a certain sense and saying, no, you're wrong about this. And that's a unified sense. So that's the first phase here that people feel unified around Jordan Peterson. But the question that I have as we move forward is, what are we going to do with the plurality of that group of people who are looking to Jordan Peterson as their voice, as their unifical, as their, you know, singular voice? And I don't have an answer to that, but that's something I look for, is what do, you know, not to diss my own religious tradition, but I mean, there is plurality in Protestantism. And we can't offer the thing that the new atheists were offering, and that's singularity of viewpoint.
Right.
I'm not saying that's a good viewpoint. I'm just saying what do we do with that? I don't know.
So it's kind of weird me watching me drinking out of my water bottle. But the point that he made was that everything kind of coalesced around Jordan Peterson. And then when people coalesced around Jordan Peterson against the celebrity atheists, but then against also the tide of identity politics, postmodern neo-Marxism, critical theorists, this whole group. And so in some ways, the IDW is sort of a coalition against. Okay, but is Jordan Peterson a Christian? Because that label then would sort of locate him. And a great many people have said it's a good thing Jordan Peterson doesn't go to a particular church, because Jordan Peterson couldn't function as he's functioning with respect to the whole group if he went to an Orthodox church or a Roman Catholic church or a Protestant church, or even if he would come out and say, I'm spiritual but not religious, or I'm a practitioner of Buddhism, but again with all of the work that he does around the Bible, the biblical series, and all of this, it's it's so clear. We locate him in this Christian conversation. Now, definitions of a Christian, just as Dr. James said here, there's a lot of them. Now again, my definition of Peterson, my best take on him is the unauthorized exorcist, and this comes out of the Gospel of Mark, where a teacher said, John, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he was not one of us. Do not stop him, Jesus said, for no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us. Truly, I tell you, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to the Messiah will certainly not lose their reward. Now, you might say, well, Jordan Peterson hasn't done a miracle. Well, in some ways, Jordan Peterson kind of has done a miracle. It might not be a miracle in the categorization that new atheists would recognize as a miracle, but what has happened in the culture since Jordan Peterson has gone, and I think what Jordan Peterson would describe that he's been through is sort of miraculous. Now, and the number of people who've become interested in the Bible and Christianity is sort of miraculous. And so Jordan Peterson, for me, is the unauthorized exorcist. But I want to read a little bit more of the passage, because this will get into the clip I'm going to show of Jordan Peterson. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them if they had a large millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea. Yeah, some people always say, well, Jesus is just so nice. Well, this is Jesus. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than for two hands, than with two hands to go into hell, where the fire never goes out. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and be thrown into hell. I want to check something here in the text here a second, because we're using English translations are a little tricky when it comes to the word hell, because as I like to tell people, which kind of bothers them when I say hell isn't in the Bible, the word hell, it's because the word hell, it's usually Hades or Gehenna that gets used in the Greek New Testament for hell. And Hades and Gehenna are a little nuanced from hell. Hell is a Christian doctrinal construct that comes through the Bible. I'm not saying hell isn't biblical. I'm not a universalist. I'm not even an annihilationist, but it's important sometimes with these passages to see if we're talking Hades or Gehenna. Gehenna is the image of this valley near Jerusalem where the ancient kings had practiced child sacrifice, and it had become a garbage dump in the time of Jesus' work in the New Testament. And so I just wanted to check on that reference. So back to the text. So we can just slip Gehenna in terms of hell here. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into Gehenna, where the worms that eat them do not die, and the fire is not quenched. Everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can you make it salty again? Have salt amongst yourselves and be at peace with one another. Now, that's a complicated text, but what I wanted to point to was Jesus' severity and the stridency of Jesus' warning. This is going to be important when we come to playing the clip of Jordan Peterson. So, Christian definitions of Christians. Christians have been debating this kind of thing for a very long time. Christians feel a certain right to define their own tribe. This is what I feel a Christian is. And in many ways, some of the different segments and separations within Christianity can be noted, not only in terms of what they believe with respect to what a Christian is, but destination, who is included, who is excluded, so on and so forth. Christians feel a certain reticence about doing so definitively with individuals, however, because God alone is the one who finally judges. Some Christians have this reticence, other Christians don't. And this is based partly on, again, Jesus' own words here in the Gospel of Matthew. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Therefore, everyone who hears these words, now pay attention, this is from the Sermon on the Mount. This is one of the few places in the New Testament that Jordan Peterson likes to go to. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall, because it had its foundations on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Now, again, listen to this. Listen for this when I play Jordan Peterson discussing with Dennis Prager whether or not he believes in God. American evangelical individualism, this version of Christianity. You're a Christian if you believe in God. Going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than going to McDonald's makes you a hamburger, Keith Green said in one of his more famous songs. Many American evangelicals, if they believe Jesus is their savior, whether or not they go to church, whatever they do with their lives, they try to be good people. Then if this is the case for them, then they're saved. Maybe they were baptized, or maybe their grandfather was baptized. And this has been true in America for a long time. Now, this is passing with the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, which I talked about in the video I did about Nathan Jacobs, and I'm trying to line up a conversation with him, which should be a lot of fun. But many people in America, especially from the Bible, but especially from the Midwest, this is sort of the default position that, well, I believe in God, I'm a good person, I do the right thing, I don't cheat on my taxes, I don't cheat on my wife, therefore I'm a Christian and I haven't killed anybody or something like that. But that whether or not they go to church or not, they consider themselves Christian. Now, Roman Catholicism, of course, has had a strong tradition about there's no salvation outside of the true church. And they, of course, themselves, along with everyone else, considers themselves the true church. And throughout church history, there's been a whole lot of excommunicating going on. The Pope excommunicated the Eastern Orthodox Church, the entirety. And I don't know if the patriarchs returned the favor to the Pope, but that generally was how it went. In fact, when there were multiple popes, they excommunicated each other. And the fear of excommunication and the threat of excommunication brought emperors to their knees back at the height of Christendom. And so this was a very big deal. It was a very big deal for the church to define who was in and who was out. And this was seen as the exercise of the keys of the kingdom that were given to Peter in Matthew chapter 18. And this, of course, is part of the ongoing conversation about Roman Catholicism. And I noted in Jonathan Peugeot's Mystical Questions and Answers in May, he touched on the papacy, and I thought his answers were quite interesting. Since Vatican II, however, the Roman Catholic Church has sort of softened its stance with respect to Protestants, and that's an ongoing conversation. Jonathan Peugeot, of course, and I should have another conversation with Jonathan coming up at some point. I should probably just email him and say, John, let's put something on the calendar, because I listened to a number of videos with Jonathan in it recently, and it's been really helpful to try to figure out how John sees the world. And also, I've been listening to more Orthodox stuff to try and get my mind around how the Orthodox Church works theologically and ecclesiastically and philosophically. Participation in the church is vitally important, and I'm thinking about probably the next monologue video like this that I do will probably have some Verveke and some stuff from an Orthodox father. Participation in the church, liturgy, Eucharist aligns you with the pattern of God in the universe. And when I talk to Jonathan, we'll see if this is, we'll try to steel man my position here, but this seems to be a fairly faithful representation of how Jonathan Peugeot sees the mission and the work of the church. Jonathan, of course, who grew up evangelical and then eventually made his way into the Orthodox Church. There's, of course, dreaded Calvinism, where it's the elect. It is God alone that calls us to himself. It is God alone who sends out his spirit and quickens our heart. It is God alone who who calls us and redeems us and takes us, which of course raises the terrible threat of double predestination, of the reprobate. Do we live in fear that we might not be part of the chosen? I've known plenty of people that have expressed that to me, both inside and outside of the Reformed Church. Well, it gets confirmed, and you can look at the Weber thesis. Bearing fruit confirms that we are his, bearing good fruit. But which fruit, and what does it look like, and when is it enough? And I recall the closing scene of the movie Schindler's List, where, you know, did I save enough? Did I save enough? And so in many ways, the Calvinist doctrine of election that is designed to offer people comfort sometimes has the double-edged effect of disturbing even people who I think should be comforted in the knowledge and assurance of their salvation, if I might use that term. Go back and see my video on the word salvation and fudging. Methodism, of course, deeply impacted how many people in the West view their Christianity. Jonathan Wesley, of course, was raised within the Anglican Church, but then his heart was strangely warmed, and he and a group of his friends created, in a sense, adapted Pietism to create Methodism. And Methodism was a hugely powerful Christian movement that went through and reformed the church and revived the church and was deeply important in the shaping of the church in the last few centuries. Charles Wesley, his brother, wrote so many of the most remarkable hymns that rose out of the period of English hymnody. But this gave us the tradition of recording the moment that you were saved. It should be a time that you know, and you ought to be able to write the time down, says the Methodists, where you know you were transformed. It's an experiential happening. It's an experience, and this is, of course, deeply pietistic. Saved means going to heaven and not to hell when you die, and so all those things that I read that Jesus said connects in with that. And there's something, so this doesn't seem to be at all what Jordan Peterson is talking about. Now, he's talking to Dennis Prager, and I don't know a lot about Dennis Prager, but the little I've seen, I always, you know, in terms of my labels for him, he's kind of a Cold War Judeo-Christian civil religionist. He's, during the Cold War, church going in the United States reached its peak. And to be a good patriot meant to go to church during the Cold War. And in many ways, during the Cold War, we recruited God sort of like an Avenger to fight communism. And so we put "In God We Trust" on our coins. And so we put "One Nation Under God" in the pledge to the flag. And in a whole number of ways, the United States got very religious to differentiate us from the godless communists. And I've said in previous videos in the past, the big transition happened after the end of the Cold War, that suddenly it's Islamic terrorists that are the ones responsible for 9/11. And so now suddenly religious people are problematic. And again, the rise of the new atheists fit into that narrative. And so what happens sort of in the Cold War Judeo-Christian civil religionist time frame is that this Judeo-Christian label got popular. And I was just having an email conversation with a really smart guy who's written some articles. And he challenges, and rightly so, a lot of the rather simplistic use of the terms Judeo-Christian, or, you know, the Marxism is very much part of the history of the West. So is postmodernity. So is critical theory. I mean, these are all parts of Western civilization. And what in fact is Western civilization? This Judeo-Christian label, I think, is far more of a political label rather than a religious label. And it sort of attempts to transcend the anti-Semitism that's been a problematic part of Western civilization for a very long time. Many Jews felt that the United States really became the promised land even more than Israel. And even though Jews continue to be the group that is most often targeted in terms of hate crimes and religious persecution in the United States, if you can use that term, or at least, you know, religious attacks, Judeo-Christian really tried to cement the relationship, a cozy, warm, good relationship between Jews and Christians that you'll see in Dennis Prager or Ben Shapiro. And so that Judeo-Christian label does it. It also sort of keeps Islam out, but you're still able to include the Mormons because you don't want to leave Idaho and Utah behind. And so this Judeo-Christian label became very important politically in the United States. And the question, again, and this is, I think, very much a Cold War leftover, is do you believe in God? For Jordan Peterson to say he didn't believe in God in 19... Well, see, he was a young man then, but in the 70s, he was a boy then. In the 70s was a very different question in the 70s. And of course, in the 70s, you had the rise of the born again movement in the mid 70s when Chuck Colson becomes born again and Jimmy Carter becomes born again. And this fits very well into the Methodism, where you have sort of inactive Christians suddenly get gripped by the Spirit. And of course, Pentecostalism grew tremendously in the latter half of the 20th century in the United States. And so this whole wave and understanding of what a Christian is, a Christian, when Chuck Colson, again, read his book, Born Again, which is a terrific book. When Chuck Colson became a Christian, his wife was confused because they'd always gone to church. And it's like, Chuck, what do you mean you're now becoming a Christian? You're baptized in the Episcopal Church and you've gone to the Episcopal Church often in your life. Why are you a Christian now when you weren't a Christian then? Oh, because I love Jesus. Well, and I feel him. He lives within my heart. And this is a big part of the definition of Christianity, but Jordan Peterson doesn't fit into any of these things, which I think, so in this clip, when Dennis Prager asked Jordan Peterson, do you believe in God? He in many ways is asking a Cold War question from a Cold Warrior. Now, one of the things before I play the clip is this clip was recorded about the same time that Jordan came to San Francisco. We had our meetup in San Francisco. And when we talked in our meetup, one of the things that we noted was that Peterson had been very, very emotional. And sure enough, a few days later, he made the rather emotional announcement that he had to call off some travel because his wife needed to have surgery. And we haven't heard any word on that. I continue to pray for Jordan and his wife that she may be healed and that she may continue to travel with him and that he may continue to do the work that he's doing. Because I think his wife is a very, very big part of this. His wife travels with him because in many ways they're a pair. Now he said many times that she's the stable one and she's his rock. And I don't know what would happen to Jordan if his wife took ill or if his wife passed away. Heaven forbid. This is something I very much don't want to see, but I don't know what would happen to Jordan. But throughout this interview with Prager, he's incredibly emotional. And a number of you people have said, oh, you've got to comment on this video. And now, as often happens with many of these videos, first time through, I didn't think there was much. But as it sits and as I listen to it again, and I think, nah, there's more there. There's more there that I didn't appreciate first time around. And so the whole video is interesting. But I'm just going to play this one section with the question about believing in God.
You have said on a number of occasions, and on every occasion that I have watched you say it, not a single person in the panel, you often talk on panels, not one person has ever actually reacted to it.
Now, I don't know why he said that. Because this has been a huge part of the discussion. And in fact, if you watch the firing point where she puts the question to Peterson, when Peterson talked to Sam Harris, when they talked about this was, you know, there's a whole lot of reaction to this. I don't know if Dennis, I hate to do a, you know, tell Paul Vanderclay, King City on the Hill type moment, but tell Dennis Prager, hasn't he been listening? This has been a huge bone of contention.
I totally get it. Nevertheless, it's one of the most important things you regularly say. You live as if there is a God.
See, and again, I think this is in terms of the entire Judeo-Christian political framework that really came to its supremacy during the Cold War. Again, I see Dennis Prager mostly as a Cold Warrior who survived the victory of his cause. You know, how then to frame? Does Jordan Peterson believe in God? This is a deep part of the framework of the American religious landscape, which is why they keep bringing it to Peterson, and why perhaps in the future Peterson might be seen as an important an important person in terms of where he's standing, and the seeming ambiguity that he has sets him apart both from the new atheists and from the cold warriors and from the modernists, and he sort of strikes out in a category of his own.
Is that correct?
Well, people ask me if I believe in God. You know, I'm going to release a podcast about that.
And I'm still waiting for it.
Because I answered that question for about 2 hours in Australia. Because people kept asking me that question, which I really don't like. I don't like that question. And so I sat and thought about it for a good while, and I tried to figure out why. And then I thought, well, I thought, who would have the audacity to claim that they believed in God if they examined the way they lived? Who would dare say that?
Now think about the texts that I read out of the Sermon on the Mount. You can see where he gets this.
To believe in a Christian sense, to actually, this is why Nietzsche said there was only ever one Christian, and that was Christ. To have the audacity to claim that means that you live it out fully. And that's an unbearable task.
Now this sort of breaks the Judeo-Christian thing too, because it's dramatically Christian.
In some sense, that's an unbearable task in some sense. I just debated Slavoj Žižek about a week ago, although it wasn't really much of a debate. It was a strange event. But he said something very brilliant, and to me, that justified the entire event, at least from my perspective. He talked about Christ's moment of crisis on the cross when he cried out to God that he had been forsaken. And what Žižek said was that what that meant was that the conditions of human existence are so tragic that even God himself in human form lost faith for a moment in the goodness of being.
And now again, this is, Žižek was quoting G.K. Chesterton, and I think it's worthwhile hunting that down in Chesterton's Orthodoxy, where this can be found, to find how Chesterton frames it.
And I thought that was a remarkable observation, because, well, if God himself would lose faith under such conditions, what would you expect from normal human beings confronted with what we're confronted by? And to be able to accept the structure of existence, the suffering that goes along with it, and the disappointment and the betrayal, and to nonetheless act properly, right? To aim at the good with all your heart, right? To dispense with the malevolence and your desire for destruction and revenge and all of that.
That's in a sense Jordan Peterson's plan of salvation, what he just articulated there. You can find it, and you can find it pretty clearly in 12 Rules for Life.
And to face things courageously and to tell the truth, to speak the truth and to act it out. That's what it means to believe. That's what it means. It doesn't mean to state it. It means to act it out. And unless you act it out, you should be very careful about claiming it.
And now again, if you read the end of the Sermon on the Mount, the house built on the rock and on the sand, this is what Peterson is speaking out of. He's pretty much articulating that.
And so I've never been comfortable saying anything other than I try to act as if God exists, because God only knows what you'd be if you truly believed.
And again, this is part of his answer about the resurrection of Jesus. And even though Sam Harris kind of backed him into a corner, and he backed down on stage against Sam Harris with almost certainly not, when he gets asked the question of the resurrection, this is the answer he comes back to again and again. This is part of the reason why I said there wasn't a lot new in this, but sort of, I heard something new in it.
I mean, if you think about it in some sense, that's the central idea in Christianity, is that if you were capable of believing, it would be a transfiguring event.
Now that's an interesting take on Christianity in some ways. And when I play the second clip, you'll see why. But there's, again, if you've been following my videos and my kind of stalking Verveke as he's going through his meaning crisis videos, I mean, this question of confessional belief or proposition, assent to propositions, whether that's belief, whether that belief is transformative. Basically, Peterson is saying you ought not to make those claims unless, in a sense, your life can cover the check.
True. If you in some way you'd be if you truly believed. I mean, if you think about it in some sense, that's the central idea in Christianity, is that if you were capable of believing, it would be a transfiguring event, a truly transfiguring event. And
you can get a sense of the Methodism in there a little bit, that this will be an event that you take place if you truly believe. Well, what do you mean by believing?
I know people experience transfiguring event, a truly transfiguring event. And I know people experience that to one degree or another, but we have no idea what the limit of that is. And we have no idea what the possibility is within each person if they lived a life that was maximally courageous and maximally truthful. You know, because maybe you're running at 60% or 70% or 20% and at cross purposes to yourself. God only knows what you'd be if you believed. And so, well, I try to act like I believe, but I'd never claim that I manage it. Because it's a lot to manage properly. And you have to be careful about claiming to manage things that you can't manage. And so that's part of the answer to that question.
Now, such an interesting answer. And of course, Christians jump in and talk about grace. And this is a point that Christians have made about Jordan Peterson's Jordan Peterson's religion, it's not a lot of grace. It's a, you know, in some ways we've said he has an Augustinian anthropology and a Pelagian soteriology, because this is a grace. This is a religion that you have to do yourself. And of course, that's going to play off different elements and different aspects of the diversity of Christians in different ways. So this is a subtle and complicated answer. And on one hand, believing, acting as if, is via pragmatism a reasonable facsimile for what Christians mean as believe. But this answer can also be deeply sanctimonious. In some ways, he might be saying, you know, he's a better Christian than anyone who claims to be a Christian. You know, I saw on Twitter somebody's snarky answer. I think it was the distributist to PSA Sitch when he said, you know, denying you're a racist is racism. And in a sense, claiming Christianity is a failure to be a Christian. That's almost what his answer says. Now, I don't think he means it in that spirit, but people listening to this who are Christians might say, now wait a minute, Jordan. A little bit later, you'll say that you'll remind us that Nietzsche said something that Christ was the only true Christian. Actually, I think it was a little bit before. I didn't play the clips up until it. But you know, there's something in this that's going to, you know, bother some Christians and say, oh, so if you actually claim to be a Christian, then you're an insufficient Christian. It almost gets to the point of, you know, the great. The Marx brothers, and the Marx brothers in this whole conversation, Marx, of course, Groucho Marx, and the Marx brothers a genealogist who was a friend of one of my distant cousins did a genealogy of my family. And one of the things they do in genealogies is they try to figure out, what famous person are you related to? Well, the famous person I'm closely related to are the Marx brothers. So there you go. You know, the great Marx brothers quit. You know, I wouldn't want to join any organization that would have me for a member. And in some sense, Jordan Peterson can't be a Christian because he wouldn't want to join an organization with anyone who would claim to be a Christian, because if you claim to be a Christian, you're an insufficient Christian. I don't think he's saying that. And I don't think he means that. But that's kind of an interesting it's, you know, if I were having a pastoral conversation with Jordan and he and I were in my office alone, I might say, well, Jordan, it's kind of an interesting answer because in a sense you're calling out all other Christians. And okay, fair enough, but it's kind of a humble brag. It's kind of a strange way of setting yourself apart from the rest. But he's just made everyone who says they believe in God a hypocrite, in a sense. So, but again, I don't think this is his intent, but this is a subtle and complicated answer. And then I watched this. Now, this video was sent to me from a lot of you send me videos, and I can't always follow up on every one, but Roots of Existentialism, and this is from the Transliminal Channel. Now, the Transliminal Channel, this guy does beautiful interviews. I mean, it's just very, very well done. And some of the best Peterson interviews early on were done by him, 2015, before Peterson, you know, really exploded in 2016 on it. Well, he's doing an interview here with Dr. Stephen Taubanek, 2019. This is the Transliminal Channel does tremendous interviews. And he said that it's an interview about existentialism, and he said this, and I thought, this shines a whole new light on Jordan Peterson's confession, as it were.
Different positions.
Oh, interesting. So a lot of the existential writing that is itself in turn somewhat opaque to many contemporary readers. But nonetheless, referenced more perhaps than Hegel, at least in North America, right? Is itself a conscious reaction to much of Hegel's writing?
Yes, absolutely. And Kierkegaard, mm-hmm. whose name means cemetery, churchyard, is one of the earliest ones to do that. So he takes up Hegel in Fear and Trembling in 1843. He takes up Hegel in Sickness Unto Death. And against Hegel's synthesizing combinatory approach, communitarian approach, Kierkegaard insists on the primacy of the individual and says that Hegel simply overlooked the importance of the individual.
Now, remember Peterson and the individual. Peterson is huge on the individual. And so hear this. They just had a really nice section on Hegel. Watch the whole video. The whole video is outstanding. Had a really nice section on Hegel. And here he's talking about the individual. It's like, ping, the consciousness. Congress said, listen to this, because he's going to be talking about Peterson. Peterson has all of these people who impacted him. And we've talked about some of the main ones. Jung, of course. Nietzsche, of course. Kierkegaard doesn't get named enough. But when you hear what this guy has to say, how Kierkegaard regarded faith. Now, remember Kierkegaard, too. On the cover of this, I put I've only read one biography of Soren Kierkegaard. And it was a tremendous book. Kierkegaard, A Single Life. I'll put the link to it in the notes. It's a wonderful biography of Kierkegaard, fairly short, very well written. Kierkegaard was a strange man, and he was born to a family that was just full of clergy, and I hesitate to use this comparison because it really isn't fair. In some ways, in the golden age of Copenhagen, Soren Kierkegaard was sort of a Milo Yiannopoulos character. A number of you are going to comment on that, and I'm not really a fan of Milo, but Kierkegaard had a way of both fascinating and annoying the church and the establishment to no end. He was obviously brilliant. He was, well, as Milo perhaps could have been. We'll see if Milo ever gets there. But he was obviously brilliant, and he would do things which deeply troubled everyone. And, you know, everyone was sure he was certainly not a Christian, but in some ways he, just like Peterson did in this video, sort of announced himself as the only Christian there, the only true Christian. All the other Christians were frauds, and the Danish church was a fraud. And this is, in a sense, what Peterson is doing. And so when I listen to Peterson say this again on Prager in a moment where emotionally he's more open and more vulnerable, there's a lot of Kierkegaard in him at this moment, and in his take on the church, and in his take on Christianity. Because against Hegel, for whom it's, you have all these titanic movements that are moving through time. Kierkegaard, it's all about the authentic individual.
So, communitarian approach. Kierkegaard insists on the primacy of the individual and says that Hegel simply overlooked the importance of the individual. And so Kierkegaard tries to cut into this combinatory moment in Hegel and say that this competition between two competing sides never actually moves to any synthesizing combinatory moment, but remains in a state of collision. This is his word, is always in a state of collision.
This is Kierkegaard's
this
word.
This is Kierkegaard. So,
and you can hear this in Peterson, that Christianity is this thing that you can never really arrive at. You know, only Jesus, Nietzsche, only Jesus can be a Christian. And so Jordan would never claim this, because this is something you can never arrive at. And that's very Kierkegaard.
So the synthesizing combinatory moment, but remains in a state of collision. This is his word, is always in a state of collision.
This is Kierkegaard's
this
word.
This is Kierkegaard. So the real individual, in his view, the true individual, the single individual, is someone who goes against the community and resists the community, actually places themselves above the community.
And that's exactly what Peterson did in that answer. He resists the church. He comes against the church. He places himself above the church.
Above the ethics of the community. And his example for this in Fear and Trembling is Abraham, especially the story of Abraham and his relation to Isaac, the story of God's command to kill Isaac.
So, I mean, to modern ears, or to my ears anyway, as a sort of a stand-in for naive modern ears, it sounds like what Kierkegaard is emphasizing relative to Hegel is almost a preference for a locus or a nexus of ideological or intellectual focus, but is, as opposed to saying, no, there's something fundamental about reality or about the human experience or the human condition, in that the individual as a concept is much more important than what it is that Hegel's pointing to. Is it more one or the other? Like, is Kierkegaard saying, no, there's something fundamental about the nature of understanding what it means to be human that Hegel is missing by the way he puts forward his arguments? Or is it more a sense of, as a personal philosophy, I, as Kierkegaard, feel that it's more important to focus on the individual and the locus of the individual?
It's the first point,
the first,
rather than
I see.
The second. So Kierkegaard actually felt, and he writes this in the book Concluding Unscientific Postscript, which is very long, very amusing, as just too long for my students to read in the term. But he emphasizes there that truth, real truth, is subjective. That really, real truth is what you yourself believe to be true.
Now pay attention to the moment we are in the conversation about truth, and look at truth with Peterson and Sam Harris, and it's exactly at this point that they're working on. Where does the subject encounter this monarchical vision? Where does the subject come into the world? Where does the subject get accounted for in truth?
That objectivity is simply a name for something you yourself believe to be true, not something that's generally true. So he wants so you see how different that is from Hegel, the true is the whole.
Very much so. In fact, yeah. It sounds like American pragmatism in a way.
It's close to American pragmatism. It's close to libertarianism, American libertarianism. It's close to a kind of anarchism. There's enormous debate about what it actually means in political terms.
Yeah, the degree to which the philosophical, I suppose, blends into the political philosophical is fraught here. But I mean, what it reminds me of is American pragmatism in a philosophical sense, but clearly this comes before that, right? So Kierkegaard's pointing to, as you say, it's his sense that this is something fundamental about the human condition.
Yeah, and it arises in the first place, I believe, from Kierkegaard's own religious upbringing. He was brought up under a system of thought within Protestantism called Pietism, which is very Lutheran and emphasizes strictly your personal relationship to the divine. But
and now there's a lot of that in Jung. And so when I talk to Skip, Skip will hear this, when I talk to Skip over with the you know, and he's giving me resources on Jung and trying to, you know, help me understand Jung a little bit better. You know, when Jung says, I don't believe, I know. Well, this is deeply at the heart of Pietism. This is Chuck Colson, who'd been baptized Episcopalian and gone to Episcopal Church, and suddenly now he knows Jesus firsthand. He lives within my heart. This is Methodism, strangely warm. This is Pietism. And so part of why Peterson is so hard to track is there's so many of these streams come into him, and so he's got the kind of mythopoetic from the Orthodox, but he's got the Pietism and the evangelicalism and the frontier evangelicalism, the rough man from Alberta. So he's got all of these strains come in, and so he's a Pietist in a sense, because it's his individual revelations, sort of as a Jungian. It's these visions that he's had. It's the dreams that he's had. And no church can, in a sense, compete with this. A church that has ritual and form, because it's personal, it's individual. It's deeply Pietistic.
Not your person called Pietism, which is very Lutheran and emphasizes strictly your personal relationship to the divine, but not your personal relationship to the divine in terms of any rational relationship, simply in terms of faith, and in a very passionate faith. Pietistic Lutheranism is a very passionate system of belief or view of belief within the individual about their relationship to God. And Kierkegaard follows this, especially in Fear and Trembling, where he says, what's amazing about Abraham is that he's both the father of monotheistic religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and a murderer, potentially. He's setting off to kill his son, Isaac. And he investigates the story in the Bible. It's also in the Quran. He says, what must Abraham have been like? And he argues there that Abraham went forward out of faith, out of passionate faith, into a position that brought him into anxiety, distress, and paradox.
There's Peterson. Anxiety, distress, paradox. That's exactly what he's saying in this. This is what faith is for Jordan. Now, this stands in such contrast to so many religious traditions, even my own, the Heidelberg Catechism. What is your only comfort in life and in death? That I am not my own. That faith is so often a comfort, and faith is seen as comfort and consolement and relief and security. But Peterson, like Kierkegaard, faith is insecurity and struggling and straining. It's carrying that cross up the hill, and God only knows what's going to happen if he doesn't make it. This is Peterson. I heard this, I thought, it's Kierkegaard. That's who Peterson is in many ways with respect to the church here.
So it wasn't a happy, comfortable kind of faith. It was a stricken faith, right? A faith built on powerful suffering.
Which is sort of the inverse of the...
And now, if you read 12 Rules for Life, perhaps in our conversations with Peterson, partly because he is it's a strange thing to say for a guy who's been out there on the stage so much, but there's a personal side of him. He's very open and discloses a lot, especially with respect to the suffering that he and his wife and his daughter went through. I mean, there's little to compare to watching your child suffer. And how many times as a parent wouldn't you have gladly stepped into the role and taken that suffering from your child? I'm speaking tonight at a C.S. Lewis organization on Jordan Peterson. And you read chapter 12. It's kind of a strange application for when you see a cat on the street, pet it. But that chapter is mostly about Michaela and the suffering and everything that he went through. And so here's this guy who's tortured during the Cold War by anxiety about the world going to blow it up, and then he grows and he and his wife have a wonderful child, and then she suffers and the pain and the turmoil and the struggle and in many ways parents, it's strangely that I'm not going to say more or less, because you can't quantify suffering in that way. But parents suffer differently because they bear within them always the haunting of responsibility. If we had done something different, if anything could have been avoided, to anything could have been done to avoid Michaela's suffering, and so it's, of course he's tortured, and this is faith for him. And absolutely, there's no question that this is a part of the Christian faith. Another part is also comfort, but this is Kierkegaard, and Kierkegaard, who's in the Danish church at the height of its power, just decries it and says, you know nothing of faith because you have no suffering. And it's a strange way for people who identify with a man bleeding, bruised, mocked, and stricken on a cross, abandoned by God. Of course it was this Chesterton quote that grabbed him. Of course it grabbed him. This is his Kierkegaardian Christianity.
This is an aside, but it's sort of the inverse of the kinds of faith and uplifting spiritual self-help sort of stuff that you hear in today's day and age.
Absolutely.
Right, where everything is supposed to be positive and reflection of positivity.
That's right.
Right? So there's something much more, I suppose, pessimistic? Would that be the right word?
Well, I wouldn't say it's pessimistic. It sounds very pessimistic, and it sounds very much negative.
I mean, at the core of my being, it sounds realistic, but...
Yeah, and that's what he said. That's what he was saying. He's saying this is what real faith actually involves.
Right.
To really believe in God takes an enormous stress. It puts you into a state of anxiety, because what's the evidence? How can we really believe in a God?
There you go. This is exactly what Peterson said. Yeah, to believe in God puts you into anxiety. He's not going to answer this question because he's anxious about it.
And that involves.
Right.
To really believe in God takes an enormous stress. It puts you into a state of anxiety because what's the evidence? How can we really believe in a God?
What's the evidence? How can we really believe? How could he dare say he believes in God? He can't say that. None of us can say that.
Involves.
Right.
To really believe in God takes an enormous stress. It puts you into a state of anxiety because what's the evidence? How can we really believe in a God? And then to try to follow what God says puts you into a very paradoxical state, because how do you know what God actually says? Has he actually spoken to you? Are you on the line with him? How do you actually know this? And how do you know what to do? So Kierkegaard is mounting a very powerful argument about faith as a passion. He says this at the end of the first section of Fear and Trembling. Faith is a passion. All humans are passionate beings. And so the important thing to think about faith is that it is not simple, happy, easy, comfortable, but that it's driven, that it'll drive you into a state of anxiety.
There it is. It's Peterson all over the place.
It'll drive you into a state of distress. In Sickness Unto Death, he actually says, it'll drive you into a state of despair. So the picture actually deepens at that point. It becomes even more fraught, even more troubling, even more concerning. What he was doing was looking at the Danish church and state at the time. He was in Copenhagen and writing in Denmark. There seemed to be this very happy relationship between church and state in Denmark. It's the 1830s and 40s in Denmark are known as the Golden Age. And Kierkegaard was criticizing this state for being superficial. He was saying it led to a very superficial understanding of what real faith actually involves. Real faith involves committing yourself to something impossible that you think nevertheless could be possible somehow. So it involves
pretty much exactly what Peterson just said. It's committing yourself to something that's impossible but could be possible. This is exactly his answer again and again.
Real faith involves committing yourself to something impossible that you think nevertheless could be possible somehow. So it involves a kind of double movement, believing in, the impossibility of the possible, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And you see how that goes right against the social nature of the church and the comfortable nature of church on Sunday and that sort of thing. It drives the faith inward and forces you to confront what it is you're really believing and why you're really believing this, right? Now, it's nice you mentioned American pragmatism. Actually, Charles Saunders Peirce, is writing a little bit after Kierkegaard's life, and he doesn't quite make it as dramatic, as melodramatic as Kierkegaard makes it. But he does make it an important, he makes it an important issue, the question of truth for the individual. What counts as true is what counts for the individual to a certain extent. He tries to set up.
There it is. Again, Pierce. Pragmatism, Peterson, what counts for the individual. This is what counts.
The law important, he makes it an important issue, the question of truth for the individual. What counts as true is what counts for the individual to a certain extent. He tries to set out the logic of that. Peirce is still quite committed to a kind of scientific understanding of truth as against Kierkegaard's faith-driven understanding. But they're moving in sort of parallel directions, I would say, along similar tracks. So there is a kind of overlap there.
So just speculatively, do you think that there's something about that historical moment that brings forth these kinds of thoughts in people like Kierkegaard and Peirce, or is
it's not only speculative, it can actually be shown. So Kierkegaard writes a famous essay in 1846 under his own name.
Now, that's really important, and if you read the biography of Kierkegaard, you'll see that he was a trickster, and he'd write under this name and that name and pseudonyms, and he's playing all over the place and really driving everyone crazy, and he dies young, and I mean, the guy was lived a crazy life, but this one he writes under his own name.
It's a famous essay in 1846, under his own name. The two other works I mentioned, Fear and Trembling and Sickness Unto Death, are under pseudonyms. But in 1846, he published an essay under the name Søren Kierkegaard called The Present Age, where he described his time. Imagine this was 1846. He said, we live in a time dominated by the media and the public.
Sounds frighteningly relevant.
Isn't that? That's really amazing when you think about social media today and the importance of media today. And he said, what you have to do is resist what the media tells you. He was talking about journals and newspapers at that time. He said, you have to resist that and think for yourself about what's really going on. The media has created a monster, he says, called the public, which media wants you to believe is real. But who is the public really, he asks in 1846. Is there a real public there, or is it a mystification created by the media? In his view, it's a mystification. So what's happening in his view is already mass media to a certain extent in the mid-1840s is creating a larger and larger sense of a public sphere, a public domain to which people should conform and into which people should fit.
And what about that did Kierkegaard find off-putting or...
He felt it took away your own subjective truth. It took away the recognition of your own responsibility, your own struggles. He called it the earthquakes of existence. He said, if you follow what the media tells you and what the public allegedly tells you, you won't register all the different earthquakes. He uses that phrase, the tremors, the trembling of your everyday life, all the shifts in mood and thought and experience that we actually go through. His suggestion there is that what you'll actually do is pave over the difficulties of everyday life and impose a smoothness.
And if you listen to this, this of course is the great sin in Peterson's lexicon and Peterson's list of sins. This is avoidance. If you smooth things over, just read 12 rules and read about all these dysfunctional relationships where they're avoiding having the conversation, where they're not challenging each other, where they're not digging deep and digging into life. I mean, this is existentialism, and this is Peterson, and this is the great sin.
Actually go through. His suggestion there is that what you'll actually do is pave over the difficulties of everyday life and impose a smoothness that is delusional, misleading, conformist, distracting.
Right, so it's the last part there that I guess has the normatively negative judgment, because the first part sounds okay for a lot of people, right? You know, life is hard. I want to smooth things over. Why shouldn't I go with the flow?
Right.
Why shouldn't I subscribe to, you know, Instagram?
Why do I have to think about things so deeply?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the Kardashians have a great Instagram feed. Why can't I just look
like
at that 24/7? Yeah. So, but there's an argument here. And is it a moral argument, or is it a phenomenological argument that Kierkegaard is making about the flimsiness or the superficiality of that?
I would say it's not only phenomenological. He's describing what's going on in his world and talking about ways of resisting what's going on, this tendency towards massification. It's also normative, because he clearly values the importance of the individual experiences as against stories from elsewhere. But it's also political, because he sees this conformism occurring in Denmark, exactly between the Danish state and the Danish church, enforcing implicitly, but also through various organs like their journals and newspapers, enforcing a kind of conformity that's taking away every person's individuality and individual experience. And this is 1846.
Is it a presaging of totalitarianism in that sense? I mean, that's an anachronistic reading, I suppose, but is some of the anxiety that Kierkegaard is expressing, anxiety that comes along with seeing the beginning of a state formation that was sort of unprecedented to that point, where the state has so much power because of the printing press, because of its alignment.
Now again, Peterson's great fear is, you know, the revival of totalitarian states. And in many ways, when you hear Peterson talk about the church, you almost get the sense, which if you're in the church, it's sort of laughable. You almost get the sense that, well, churches are little mini totalitarian communities, and the churches certainly can be that. Churches can be very totalitarian in many ways, but often when I listen to Peterson talk about the church, you get the sense that that's exactly what he thinks churches are, and the lying pastors. And again, this is Kierkegaard. And this is, you know, this is where this is lining up. Now wait to see who he mentions next in the list.
I mean, with other normative systems in society like the church, that I guess simply had not yet quite been, it was still fairly unprecedented in European society. That was the moment in history, I suppose, where it was all congealing, right?
He didn't use the phrase totalitarianism, and he didn't criticize notions of totality, but I do believe this is the track he's on. He's criticizing the overwhelming conformism in state formations, media formations, church formations that seem to be congealing around this time.
Right.
The interesting thing about it is, at that time in the 1840s, it was a convergence around the thought of modernity, the thought of the priority of science, of technology, of business, of organization.
Now, go back to my conversation with Dr. James. This is the vision, okay? This is the vision of modernity. This is the vision with reductive naturalism, where now with reason we can establish for ourselves here on earth the kingdom of heaven. And that's very deep in Hegel. Hegel believed that all of this comes together, and Geist and mind are all one, and the earth will be full of, everything will be the same as we, once we finally reach the pinnacle. And Kierkegaard stands out of this and says, I'm not going along with it. You can put me in jail and I won't eat. I'll do a hunger strike. This is Jordan Peterson protesting C-16.
Of calculability, of regulation, or the convergence around the thought of modernity, the thought of the priority of science, of technology, of business, of organization, of calculability, of regulation. So Kierkegaard, I'm going to put him forward as one of the great precursors of what I would call modernism, which thrives on resisting modernity by saying that underneath modernity, something else is going on that you need to be aware of. And the great... He doesn't write about this, but the great symbol of modernity in the mid-19th century is a building in London called the Crystal Palace that was put up in 1850 by Queen Victoria and some of her architects. And this was meant to celebrate British technology and science. It was sort of the perfect utopian building meant to show how far British science and technology had gotten and how successful they were at bringing everyone together. Kierkegaard didn't comment on this, but he has a sense of that kind of vision that he's resisting. It's really Dostoevsky in 1864, 9 years after Kierkegaard died, in the Notes from Underground, in his character of the Underground Man, who attacks the Crystal Palace and says, you think this is so great, you think this is so positive, everything seems so wonderful there, but look at what you're actually doing. You're taking away, Dostoevsky, in the Voice of the Underground Man, says, you're taking away freedom. You're taking away the power of the human will to do something even contrary if it wants to. You're imposing a conformist kind of thinking around the values of business, science, and technology that is reducing human freedom.
So is what Kierkegaard, and then to a greater degree Dostoevsky, what they're resisting, is it the emergence of the intertwining of these various facets of modern life into what was becoming the new sort of socio-political unit that, that was migrating away from, let's say, church and empire into something more like nation and state?
Yes, that's a great way of describing it. And this comes out perhaps even more vividly in Nietzsche's response to the establishment of the Second Empire in Germany under Bismarck. Nietzsche is very critical of this moment, whereas many people in Germany at the time, under Bismarck, the Second Empire, were very happy, were very celebratory. They felt, this is great, we're a modern state, now we're a modern empire, now we can compete with the British and the French and the Russians. This is a wonderful moment for us. Nietzsche attacked this violently, following the lines, the suggestions that Dostoevsky and Kierkegaard had set out, criticizing the conformism and the, what should I say, the uniformity, the calculability that was arising from these modern notions of nation and state, still enshrined in the empire at this time,
right.
But the sense, the seeds of the modern nation or the modern state were already appearing at that time. And it really wasn't, so just to finish the point, there was a critic, Georg Brandes, who in 1888 said, after he'd read some Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, and Kierkegaard, said, you know what? These three writers are all moving in similar directions. They all need to be seen as criticizing the modern world and what's happening in the modern world.
Watch the whole video. The whole video is tremendous, and Transliminal does a tremendous job. And I saw that, and I thought, I know what kind of Christian Jordan Peterson is. He's a Kierkegaard. But now he, you know, I was going to make some comments on his talk with Milo in this, but I want to finish listening to Sitch and Adam go at it. But Kierkegaard is no trickster like, or Peterson is no trickster like Kierkegaard was. Though Peterson continues to give certain people fits. But this vision of Christianity, this vision of faith, this vision of what authentic faith is, this vision of you cannot rest, you will be heaving that heavy cross up the hill to the city of God, and you'll be doing this until the day you die. You have this cross to bear, and you'd better face it, and you'd better not avoid it, and you've got to face up to the terrible existence of being, and plant your feet and put your shoulders back, and now Kierkegaard is far more the trickster, but Jordan Peterson is in a sense the Prussian soldier working his way up this hill. Fascinating, but that is faith for Peterson, and all of these elements of Kierkegaard are right there in Peterson. I never saw it before, and I saw this video on Kierkegaard, and I thought, there's Peterson. Now, this, of course, will not satisfy the debate. And again, tonight I'm going to be talking about Peterson and C.S. Lewis, unless and until Peterson joins a church, which I don't think he will. He's going to continue to play in the space of Kierkegaard. He will use tribal dynamics to disrupt Christian tribalism, which isn't a bad thing, because you know, these tribalism within Christianity is something that Jesus in the Gospel of John is clearly not happy with, and Paul in 1 Corinthians is clearly not happy with, and so this is something that Christians must struggle against. And he will both tease and troll dogmatists of many varieties about his identity. But bang, Kierkegaard, there it is, blew my mind. Jordan Peterson is a Christian in Soren Kierkegaard. That is how he is. And so I'm going to have to, this has reframed my thought about Jordan Peterson's relationship with Christianity. Now, I know a lot of y'all are going to have thoughts on this, so go ahead and put them in the comments, and I can't wait to see what you have to say.